Hello everyone, I'm Kelvin from Citi Cash Equity Sales, and thank you for joining our Citi 30 call today. So a lot has been going on in the past few days in the macro scene. We thought of bringing together our esteemed colleagues to help us make sense of the markets. Since two nights back, we have U.S. Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent surprising markets by doubling the size of liquidity support buybacks for the 10 to 30 years Treasuries. That technically seems as a liquidity injection from the Treasury Department, providing support to credit and growth stocks. That said, we have seen a weak tech sector performance. CDS spread for Nvidia, CoreWeave, as Oracle has started rising again. With these confusing reactions in markets, we thought of bringing our research team to have a discussion on these issues. We have Veronica Clark from U.S. Economist team, Dan Sorif, the head of U.S. Investment Grade Strategies, and of course, our Scott Cronert, who wears many hats, which includes U.S. and global equity strategies for Citi. So we hope this will be an interactive discussion. Please drop us questions in the webcast or drop me an email at kelvin.neo@citi.com. So we'd be love to address all the questions we have today. So thank you for your time, everyone. So in essence of time, we'll just jump straight to Q&A. So Veronica, in your view, what drove the action of U.S. Secretary of Treasury to intervene in the U.S. bond market?
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 V。 CN202101130.
Markets with the surprise buyback.
No, happy to opine on it, but I think we will really know. We did hear from Bessent today. He was on CNBC in the New York hour, just talking about the thin liquidity, buybacks to help support liquidity. He mentioned how the move higher in yields did not necessarily seem in line with the fundamentals as he was seeing it. Obviously we've had more debt issuance. That's some of the factor. I think what investors will probably take from this is that we just had this move higher in yields that had gotten to a point that was somewhat uncomfortable. So maybe it's around 5.30 for that 30-year yield that we'll kind of see as maybe somewhat of a sticking point for the Treasury now. That's maybe where they start to get a bit uncomfortable. It was obviously a surprise announcement. It was not on the normal, quarterly refunding announcement schedule. It didn't necessarily seem like there was any specific trigger event. Just this idea that, this move higher in yields had gotten to the point of being a bit uncomfortable. As Bessent described today, it's, liquidity concerns and whatnot. He did say that, doubling the buybacks is not necessarily a limit. They could do more. I think, they were just getting uncomfortable with that level of yields.
Thank you. So Dan, so what are your thoughts? And how has credit market taken to this move? Do you mind sharing your thoughts and feedback from clients?
Sure. I would say that it's been a mixed signal, and the sort of the medium term effect of the announcement, I think, is somewhat ambiguous, which is always challenging because the credit markets are trying to digest right now a huge capital raise from AI related firms, which have been issuing at essentially double the pace of the prior year. And one of the things that they're extremely dependent upon right now is stability in fixed income markets. And so I think the medium term effect of the announcement depends on your view of which side of the whether this which side of the coin you're looking at. I mean, on the one hand, there was sort of a sharp rally in rates that we saw on the news, which typically leads to somewhat wider spreads. We typically see spreads widen about 20% of the move in rates in the opposite direction. It would certainly tend to lower borrowing costs for firms, although I'm not sure that that's really been one of the major catalysts for I'm not sure that there's been a decision driver. But what's really important is more on the demand side. What's important is establishing and retaining confidence in U.S. dollar, the U.S. fixed income markets, and the source of really the primary source of long duration yield for investors around the globe. Investors across Asia have been looking to the U.S. dollar fixed income markets, and specifically the U.S. corporate bond markets as a source of liquid, high quality, and long duration income to match up against very rapidly rising local wealth, and you know, in order to be able to underwrite long duration liabilities such as annuities and other insurance type of products. So what that requires is confidence in U.S. fixed income markets, which I think the announcement is designed to address. The ultimate deciders, I think, will be the fixed income investors. We need to watch the direction of the dollar, appetite for U.S. dollar risk, views on the U.S. as a stable source of both economic growth and a stable source of yields. Last thing I'll say is that, you know, one, I think, concern that we all have, you know, wherever you sit in the world, is that inflation has been historically incompatible with long duration fixed income markets. So when inflation becomes not just high, but de-anchored, and you have high and volatile inflation, it can be very difficult for an economy to sustain, support, or grow a long duration fixed income market. And what we're seeing today is that U.S. firms have been able to tap into 10, 20, 30, 100 year tenors and attract capital from around the globe. So the dollar remains that there still remains that confidence in the dollar. And we need to kind of digest the longer term effects of this one policy in the context of other announcements from Treasury in the future.
Thanks, Dan. We'll come back on this confidence in dollar shortly after, but we'll move over to Scott to probably help us to understand the weakness in the tech sector despite that dovish or liquidity injection that we've seen from the state of Treasury. Scott, over to you.
Thanks, Kelvin. It's a great question. So, you know, what I would just say is if there's one word here that we just have to keep in mind, it's uncertainty. And we know that markets and investors tend to sell uncertainty. They'll buy the alleviation of it. And from an equity perch, what it happened in our opinion is that, you know, we had gone into the quarter expecting some pullback in the semiconductor space and hardware as well off of the sharp Q2 move. We've seen that. We were also arguing for a reset into the Q2 reporting period, where we're looking for some evidence from the AI CapEx spenders that the adjoining revenue growth is going to commensurate with the investment. I'd say, generally speaking, we got pretty decent evidence of that. So you went into a period feeling a little bit more comfortable. If you look at a quarter to date of the mega caps, you've got several that have outperformed: Amazon, Apple, Nvidia, and Microsoft. But you also have the other half of the Mag 8, if you will, that have been, you know, more defined underperformers. Cutting to the chase here, what I think we're looking at is, with the to Dan's point, the issue regarding how the financing of a lot of the CapEx buildout will unfold, and concessions that that the issuers will have to face, combined with the uptick in oil prices that we've seen recently as the Iran circumstance continues with no apparent end in sight, it counterbalances what we had seen in terms of the labor data off of the July non-farm payrolls, as well as the recent inflation prints. So you went very quickly from a point a week ago where you could look at the aggregate macro circumstance and feel fairly comfortable that the Fed didn't need to tighten, that you'd also have a dynamic where you can look at the opportunity for inflation to come down, take some pressure off rates, trigger soft landing sentiment, and just like that, you're back in an uncertain mode. So the tech component is feeling, I think, that element at work here, but it's varying day by day. So the bottom line here is that we've got a new phase of uncertainty that's a function of oil prices, inflation expectations, and therefore the Fed, that's going to grapple with what we saw out of Q2 earnings, which was fairly strong and persistent earnings strength across most sectors, which has us, you know, sort of an ongoing optimistic view for the year-end outlook for U.S. equities. But clearly, we need to navigate some of these elements in the shorter term that have gotten in the way of the sentiment read that we had literally a week ago.
Right. Thank you, Scott. Gentlemen, we hope you find this useful. Do drop the questions in the webcast. We'll try to address it. Without further ado, I'll move over to Veronica. Veronica, so as the media has been flagging, U.S. public debt has crossed U.S. $40 trillion. Coupled with the buyback, we're seeing surge in alternative assets like Bitcoin, precious metals. So what's your take on this? Is there a concern on de-dollarization coming back into the team? Is this knee-jerk reaction warranted?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what we say is warranted or not. I mean, all of this, you know, has to do with this dollar, you know, de-dollarization, you know, idea that we've seen before, right? We've seen this, you know, we saw it a year ago. So it's not that this is something new necessarily. And yeah, those trades can work maybe for a minute. So yeah, that's warranted in that sense. But I think at the heart of that question and the whole issue of, yeah, moving away from dollar and dollar assets, you know, gets at, do investors think that the U.S. government is not going to be in a position to pay its debts? And I don't think that is that's what's happening here. I don't think that's necessarily an element. Obviously, you know, some of it can just be, there is a lot of debt out there, right? You know, government debt, corporate debt, you just need to be more compensated for it. We know that we're getting, you know, less guidance from the Fed. We're adding, you know, risk premium, you know, because of that. Maybe just bigger questions around, yeah, the issuance outlook. And so, yeah, you add, you know, premium because of that also. So it's related to the size, rather than, you know, are we really moving away from dollar assets because we don't trust the U.S. government anymore? I don't think that's what's happening necessarily. But yeah, there's a lot of debt out there. So yeah, maybe you diversify to other assets too.
Thank you. So Dan, so I'll move over to you as the credit. How do you guys think? Because clearly we saw dollar weakening happening on the back of this too. And I'll just maybe is a random correlation, but we are seeing Google issuing kangaroo bonds recently, or Alphabet for Meta. So what are your thoughts on that? Will we see more of a such trend?
Sure. So a couple of things to unpack there. First is that the scale of funding needs for the AI, the build out of AI related assets such as data centers, GPUs, and other computing costs, has required kind of an all hands on deck kind of approach to funding and financing. So we've seen some issuers not only tap maturities across from 2 years out to 30, but we've seen funding in CAD and euros and sterling and yen, in Aussie dollar, and who knows what's next. So it shows, I mean, global credit investors have become quite comfortable with many of the largest U.S. Corporate issuers. We've seen markets for U.S. dollar debt surface in places like Taipei, where a Formosa bond market developed, in order to raise, where U.S. issuers were able to raise significant sums for many years. So there's nothing really new there, and I think it shows that to the extent that there's any kind of narrative around de-dollarization or sell U.S., I don't really see it, because it's really kind of buying everything you can get, related to the U.S. at this stage. Dirk Willer, and team, from our macro strategy group published a note, on the U.S. Treasury announcement in which they highlighted that, you know, they said that the main price to pay for trying to control yields is a weaker U.S. dollar. And that interfaces with credit in a couple of ways. One is that global investors will sometimes try to juice the return on a U.S. dollar fixed income investment in credit by under hedging to some degree, by taking on a little bit of currency risk that the dollar is going to appreciate. And so to the extent that expectations increase for further dollar weakness, that could require hedge ratio, currency FX hedge ratios to increase, which can reduce the attractiveness of U.S. corporate bonds on a fully hedged basis. So if you're going from 60% hedged to 80% hedged or fully hedged, that's going to cost you just given the rate differentials that we see in the market. And the second would be, places like Japan where investors have continued to seek out U.S. dollar, credit. And U.S. dollar spread products of a wide variety, given the behavior of the local rates market and local currency. And so this sort of, one of the things we've been waiting for, we've been watching for signs of, is any indication that Japanese investors may start to express a preference to repatriate funds back out of the U.S. into yen fixed income. Up until this point, we've not really been given much reason to see that, despite yields having reached, JGB yields having reached, quite high levels. So I think that'll be another question that's really open. But just to kind of, put a finer point on it, there's really been no evidence that we can see that as far as U.S. appetite for U.S. credit from outside of the U.S., we've not seen any strong indication that there's been a shift, over the course of this year. We've seen average monthly rates of inflows into U.S. corporate U.S. issuer bonds go from around $15 billion at year end per month to around $30 billion in the first quarter, and we've been running at around $50 or $60 billion a month in the second quarter. So that's been something that continues to help absorb this the very strong supply. So putting the Treasury, it's a lot to kind of think about, but I think the Treasury announcement really surfaces a lot of complex issues. But for the most part, they continue to point to strong appetite for U.S. corporate risk and, from abroad.
Thank you, Dan. Moving over to Scott, closer to home to equities. Scott, there's a media mentioning case for Japan. Whereby the rising JGB bond yields has come to the point whereby the mark-to-market losses in bonds is causing a stir in the financials, be it the insurance or banks. So while we're seeing the rising long-dated bond yields for U.S. rising, so at what point do you think we will see a similar a change in style or sector rotation from equity investors? Because that has been a concern that probably we are seeing in Japan now.
Right. I think the immediate answer is that as we look at this bond yield circumstance, the market reaction in equities has been fairly sector specific. So you've seen banks, as an example, struggle for the better part of this week in response to some of the yield curve dynamics. Okay, but what I want to say on this is, number one, fundamentally, from our perch, things are still in very good shape. We had very strong Q2 earnings with solid upside surprise, but very little follow through in terms of expectations for Q3 and 4. So I think there's an underlying level of conservatism that's there in the expectations, making us comfortable with the fundamental trajectory for earnings into the end of the year. Okay, now, so what that means is that when we're wrestling with this latest yield backup, if you will, I'm going to keep coming back to this issue around oil prices and 10-year yields. And I think the issue is one of directionally, where do they go? And from a sentiment perspective, where do you draw lines in the sand? Okay. So a 480 10-year on the way to 5%, we think is not good. Over the past couple of years, we've seen that level of 10-year. Come in and exert some valuation pressure. Oil prices is a bit more fungible. We've drawn a line at $80 and we're at above that now on WTI. So I'd like to see oil prices come back down. I need that to support the broadening thesis, very simply, because what comes with that is confidence in Veronica's rate outlook. And what I would say is soft landing, if not Goldilocks economic conditions that way. So we're watching some of these levels as a signal for whether we have to come off of the broadening playbook. But at this point, I don't think that's in the cards for us. I think we're still going to be looking at the broadening dynamic either as a function of economic conditions or as an anti-AI trade to be front and center in investor attention here. Now, as it pertains to the AI trade itself, again, in our view, we're still looking at an AI-related boom. It's manifesting in different ways. And the winners and losers and the market perception of winners and losers is vacillating, okay? And so I think we're at a point here when we're looking at the AI trade. I need it also, along with broadening, to get to our year-end 8,100 target. I'm pretty comfortable with what we're seeing fundamentally and what we suspect ultimately will happen on the rate side, that we're still in pretty good shape for that, but we're clearly being tested right now. So you run to new highs last week, not a surprise given what we're looking at the past couple of days to see the pullback and some retrenchment off of that latest run. But bottom line is, you know, color is still constructive. We got an eye out on lots of issues. Most of the issues that are a concern for us are probably more 27, 28 concerns.
Thank you, Scott. We have a question from the floor, and this one, first one is probably addressing to Veronica. Do you have any thoughts that what Scott Besson has done sends a signal about the longer-term management of the U.S. Treasury debt profile? Because any thoughts on that? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I will ultimately leave that question for our rate strategy team, who has to put all those numbers together. But yeah, it is interesting. I mean, the expectation, you know, going into this new administration was that at some point, not immediately, they were going to have to increase coupon, you know, the size of coupon issuance again. We've been issuing, you know, much more relatively, right, more shorter end debt and not so much the longer end. And at some point that would have to increase. I think this announcement, yeah, definitely does change the probabilities and timing of that somewhat. It does seem like, you know, we've kept pushing out when we would think that announcement is coming, and now we're just pushing it out even more, right? Like, could you at some point be getting rid of?
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 VCN20210130。
Of maybe like the 20-year auction, I don't know. Again, I'll leave that to our rate strategy team, but yeah, it does seem like, you know, okay, this was some kind of line in the sand potentially for how comfortable they are with the move higher in yields. And yeah, there are a lot of things that could still push yields higher that you're going to try to avoid now, right? Like, you're not increasing coupon issuance potentially anytime soon. But yeah, we'll have to see how things shake out.
Right. And would that drove concerns about how U.S. debts will be continued to be funded?
Yeah, again, it could be that, you know, all the, right, you know, issuance just happens much more short term than maybe we were thinking a couple months ago.
Got it. And the next question that I get is probably addressing for Dan. What do you think of the impact for U.S. agency securitized debt on this move? Because one is the volatility of the U.S. It might raise concern about volatility of the U.S. long end, but also signal potential for the maintenance of stable range at the longer end, which might suggest a constructive outlook on agency spread and the extra spread offered by negative convexity profile. I guess this is more of a credit question.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can sort of tackle the question from the perspective of sort of spread product and dollars. I mean, I think, you know, the U.S. Yeah. Treasury market serves both as a sort of an alternative asset, meaning more of like it's more competitive in the sense that, you know, investors have a choice to either buy treasuries directly or to buy some sort of spread product such as agency MBS or corporates. But they also serve as sort of a liquidity foundation because they serve as the hedging vehicle for investors looking to isolate the exposure to a spread product. So being able to buy a 20-year corporate bond, a new issue, and then hedge it with 20-year treasuries, you know, is something that supports, I think, you know, strong functioning of the spread product markets. So I think it's challenging. You know, you can look at this from a supply demand perspective. As Veronica highlighted, you know, this may start to shift some expectations around where on the curve we see more government bond supply, which could, you know, from a supply demand lens, lead to stronger valuations for alternative assets, you know, in the spread product market. But to the degree that these changes shift expectations for liquidity in the treasury market, I think that could, you know, that has you know, that could have potentially even broader effects. So that would be, I guess, my take on that.
Right. Thank you. We hope you address the question. Now move back to Veronica. So just to remind everyone, Citi has been a duff when it comes to Fed interest rate expectations. So Veronica, would you mind refreshing us on House view and your latest thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we are still very much a dovish outlier. And yeah, maybe first, even with, you know, respect to the move that we've seen in long end yields, I think there is a bit of a narrative and perception. Obviously, it's caused by many different things, right? The debt issuance, you know, move higher in oil prices. Rates are still moving with oil prices. But there is a bit of a perception that, okay, there's maybe a Fed credibility issue, right? If they're too dovish and not taking inflation seriously, maybe that's some of what's caused this move. It is interesting to see in the last, you know, week or so, couple days, that inflation break evens have moved higher with the latest move higher in yields. But we're only back to levels where we saw in June, right? So inflation break evens, the way that the market is pricing inflation, is still very low. It's really not telling you that there's a big inflation problem. Now the next pushback to that is that, well, market break evens are based on CPI inflation and the Fed targets core PCE, which has been much stickier. So are they not taking inflation seriously? They're not taking core PCE seriously. But something like a 10-year break even, CPI and PCE are not going to diverge for that long. So the market seems to be trusting that, you know, we will have more anchored inflation. So I don't really know if there's this big credibility issue. And yeah, the way that we see then, okay, very, you know, coming back to very near term, the way we see things playing out for this year is, you know, I think slowly but surely, we are starting to price out those hikes that we have had priced for the Fed. And it's inflation data alone, I think, that can do that. So we obviously had the softer June CPI reading, a very benign July CPI last week. The last couple months of data, we are also estimating, you know, we have seen softer PCE readings finally. So we had very strong PCE inflation first half of the year, and that seems to have slowed. And I think there's a couple important things that will happen really within the next 2 months. One, the week before the September FOMC meeting, we will get CPI data for August. It looks like CPI, core CPI, can be something like 2.3 in that reading. There's some big base effects there. That is essentially consistent with 2% inflation. That's where CPI was averaging in 2019. Usually PCE runs a bit softer. So that looks the best that it has yet. The monthly PCE readings, I think, will continue to look better in the second half of the year. And then end of September, and it's not clear if the Fed is going to be forecasting it this way in the September SEP or not, but we are expecting some big downward revisions to core PCE. Those come with the annual revisions on September 30th. That should lower core PCE potentially below 3% finally, and should at least make you question, I think, the signals that you're taking from core PCE. Because if you look across a range of measures, like all the trimmed means, the median PCE, obviously core CPI, all of them are only 10-20 basis points from where they were averaging in 2019, when obviously policy rates were much lower and the Fed was cutting. So I think inflation alone can get us to price out the hikes within the next month or so. And then, yeah, we are still expecting cuts later in the year. Right now we have those penciled in starting in October. You know, risk obviously could be later. But that then comes down to seeing some more weak labor market data, which we saw that in July. It's the third year in a row where the July jobs report was surprisingly weak. And that happens because there is seasonality in this data that, you know, tends to mean you get weaker labor market data end of the summer into the fall. And we think we'll see more of that. And then, yeah, you're the closest to target by some measures on inflation that you've been in a while, and the labor market is weakening again. A lot of officials, I think, will still think rates are restrictive at that point and would be thinking about lowering them as we were going into this year. But yeah, we'll have to see how the data evolve, but I think a lot can still change in the next 6 weeks, maybe.
Right. Well, now still dovish. Yeah. Over to you then. July, we saw a credit scare in the hyperscaler bond market. So what's the latest view and concerns that credit investors have in this space?
Sure. We've seen a pretty extraordinary, supply. That said, it's not the first time that the U.S. credit markets have seen a single sector boost supply well above kind of the typical pace. You know, in 2021, we saw U.S. banks issue at a much, much faster rate, going from around 20, you know, if we look at sort of intermediate yields or intermediate tenors, we saw bank issuance run from around 20% of intermediate supply to around 40% of IG intermediate supply, a really big increase. And banks underperformed in the market with spreads kind of moving from around 15 basis points all the way up towards 80 basis points wide of peer, you know, of comparable bonds in the market. Mm-hmm. And so that I think is a very useful comparison, to make, because what's happened with technology issuers is that, you know, at the beginning of 2024, tech companies were issuing only about 10% of non-financial debt in the market. That's, you know, increased to around 40% at the current pace. And we've seen spreads, you know, kind of make a 40 basis point round trip with tech underperforming. So I think what we're seeing is that deals are pricing, you know, issuers are having to offer somewhat higher concessions to investors in the new issue market, not so much on a credit concern, but just given that the opportunity cost of participating in a new issue deal right now is not being able to participate in the next one. And so once you start to see dealers, issuers have to come with higher concessions, they tend that can tend to persist for a while until at least the market feels that the pace of issuance may be slowing. But what I would say is that valuations are already somewhat reflecting that. From a fundamental side, we continue to see very low metrics related to credit leverage among the higher rated hyperscalers. We're also seeing, you know, measures like interest coverage look quite manageable, considering that, as you know, as Heath Terry says, in his latest publication, you know, the consensus continues to underestimate future revenue growth tied to AI. The one metric that I think investors are starting to watch a little bit is, the relationship between CapEx and EBITDA. So, you know, the ability of companies, to grow free cash flow, to grow their earnings, at a pace similar to their CapEx is something that the market will want to see. But, you know, we are starting to see those ratios, tick up to somewhat uncomfortably high levels, but I certainly wouldn't call it a panic. I wouldn't call it, you know, what I call it is just more of at this stage, at least a liquidity strain.
Thank you. Finally, Scott, great call. To downgrade our technology mark to a neutral call. So broadening our calling on broadening and rally, we should touch on. So just kindly quickly run through your thoughts on equity strategies now.
Okay. So let me just be clear on this. I don't think there's any real change in our view. I think what's with the pullback that we've seen in the semi hardware component, the rally that we've seen in the software side, and the Q2 results, we got a lot of what we expected, and I would say it's safe to step back into the tech waters, if you will. Okay. Now I would underscore a couple of things. We're well over 3 years now into this AI tailwind, and so I think we have to expect that the company specific and industry group return profile is going to be a little bit less aggressive than it's been over the past several years. I think the big moves are probably behind us. Okay. Number one. Number two, I think what this means is that, you know, as you look at how to position for the ongoing AI tailwinds, which Dan's comment on Heath Terry's view is that they're still going to persist here. I do think you want to be careful on two fronts. Number one, you know, deciding where to place investment decisions on longer term winners or potential winners, versus number two, you know, areas where you think there are still trading opportunities. So commodity semis, as an example, would be an ongoing area of trading opportunity, but still a little bit more difficult to assess the fundamental setup in 28 through 30, whereas the market's already priced in a lot of the 27 dynamic. So bottom line here, we want to be careful, but we want to be involved in the AI playbook here. And it's with this differentiation between, you know, who you think longer term winners will be and not, and trading opportunities. And keep in mind, we still have a lot of supply coming at us as we go into the back half of the year here. So that's going to be an ongoing issue that will probably keep us from being a bit more aggressive to the upside. The broadening playbook is still very much in our view in play, but coming back, it does. I don't need all of Veronica's dovishness, but what I need is at a minimum to see some of this Fed hawkish dynamic in terms of market pricing and a rate hike to essentially come out of the market as we go into the fall months. So bottom line here, we're going to stay the course, pick and choose our spots on the tech component, keep a close eye on the hyperscalers and the ROI discussion, which is still going to be a source of controversy. At the same time, you know, allow that underlying economic conditions are still pretty supportive of fundamentals broadening.
Thank you, Scott. Ladies and gentlemen, we're running out of time. I hope you find this useful. You know our analysts now. Do reach out to them or your sales to arrange a call if you're keen. We hope you have a good day. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.